It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The subject for today is impermanence. But before I present Dogen's Waka, I'd like to make a kind of strange reminder, or it may not be a reminder. Perhaps some of you don't actually know this. A lot of times I say things like, well, Dogen thought, or Dogen's idea is such and such. And the reminder is that any time I mention Dogen and Dogen's thinking, anytime I mention that, what it means is Dogen's experience from his own zazen, from his own shikantaza. Dogen is not a philosopher. He's a practitioner. And that's all. He's just a practitioner. And so when he says, this is the way it is, or this is what I think, or whatever, it means this is what was revealed to him in his zazen. That said, regarding impermanence, he requests us to quietly think whether this present life and all beings that are born together with this life are together with this life or not. Of course, he already answered the question by the way he asked the question, but it means the whole world is born when I'm born. And this entire world is living together with me. And when I die, the entire world dies together with me. When we see that we're only one tiny part of this network of dependent co-arising, which is always moving and changing, and that we're just a little knot on this boundless net, it's easy to see that when we touch one knot, the entire network is affected because of the interconnection. And at the same time, everything is together with this person, self, and yet self doesn't exist. And yet self doesn't exist. It's empty. And so this is shunyata, emptiness, and dependent co-arising together. Usually we view sunyata as nothing, but Dogen's view is positive. Everything is part of my life, or I am part of everything, and everything in me is one. We work together. It's a very dynamic view of life. Interestingly, this is captured even in the fairy tale of Sleeping Beauty. When the lilac fairy comes in and says that she'll sleep for 1 year instead of being dead, as the curse that she received from the evil spirit Caribous, when the lilac fairy comes in and says you'll sleep for only 1 year instead of being dead, her entire world, the Russian Empire, goes to sleep with her. And when she's awakened by the prince's kiss, her entire world is awakened with her. I wonder if the power of myths like that is partly the ultimate truths that they so delightfully present to us. Another not quite so delightful but powerful presentation of this truth of Impermanence was presented by George Balanchine when he gave this lesson in a performance, and it will help you to know, when I tell you this short story, it will help you to know that he loved Tchaikovsky, like he loved not just his music, but he loved Tchaikovsky, and that Tchaikovsky committed suicide. So Tony Bentley, one of his ballerinas, tells the story that when Balanchine choreographed music for the final night of the 1981 Tchaikovsky Festival at Lincoln Center, so he choreographed the final night, and he had, at the end, he had a little boy enter in a simple white tunic holding a lit taper. And the boy stood alone, center stage. The single flame was the only light in the entire black cave of the New York State Theater. At Balanchine's insistence, even the exit signs were illegally extinguished. The little boy blew out the candle. There was black, pitch black. The audience gasped, and they were no longer observing the performance. They were the performance now. No applause. In that moment of total darkness, Balanchine gave his audience the ability to really see. The audience was filled with silence and assaulted and blessed by a glimpse of their own transients. So now it isn't just about Tchaikovsky's transients, but their own transients. And Balanchine said in an interview that he derived this right from a Sufi parable. A small boy enters with a candle, and a man asks him, "Tell me where this light comes from." And the boy blows out the candle and replies, "If you tell me where this light went, I will tell you where it comes from." So the theme today is impermanence and no self, which are joined at the hip as a bedrock for Buddhism, impermanence and no self. And you won't see it immediately in Dogen's Waka, but you'll see it a little ways on. And this one has a title. It's called Wondrous Mind in Nirvana. So the short poem is, "Always, since these flowers invariably bloom in my home village, the colors do not change, although spring passes." Again, "Always, since these flowers invariably bloom in my home village, the colors do not change, although spring passes." And Okamura Roshi comments that in the Shobogenzo fascicle Total Function, Dogen wrote, "The great way of all Buddhas, when it is completely penetrated, is liberation and manifestation." And I'm going to tell you what this means. It means things are manifested completely as they are, and yet at the same time, they are liberated from what they are due to impermanence and no self. For example, think of a baby. A baby manifests itself completely as a baby, and yet, because of impermanence, that everything changes and nothing stays the same, and no self, it has within itself the force to be liberated from its own babyhood. The same is true of toddlers, teenagers, 20-somethings, old people. So let's just pause, because this is big. This is a big thing. And I'm going to say it again in a slightly different way. Very simply, Gail is completely Gail, yet at the same time, because of impermanence and no self, there is within this being called Gail a force to liberate her from being the Gail that you see into just as completely manifested older person, and the same Gail without an inherent individual self will disappear as this manifestation of Gail into the interconnected net of all beings. We are all always in the interconnected net of all beings. But in old age, the inherent force that liberates one into death, the natural end of birth. This is why Dogen says, things are manifested completely as they are, and yet at the same time, they are liberated from what they are due to impermanence and no self. This is so profound, I think. I just think this is the essence of Buddhism, and it's so profound. I'll just read that one sentence again. Things are manifested completely as they are, and yet at the same time, they are liberated from what they are due to impermanence and no self. Suzuki Roshi spoke on the subject of no self very sweetly when he said, you may remember this, when he said, when you do something without any feeling of having done something, that is you yourself. That is you yourself. Like a bird flying through the sky, you are completely one with everyone, and you don't feel self-conscious. That is the mind transmitted from Buddha to us. That is self-respect, and at the same time, liberated from crusty old ideas about yourself. So what is self-respect? In Buddhism, there's the idea that the self lacks an independent self-existence, and that nothing in the world exists by virtue of itself, but instead depends for its existence on the interrelationship with everything. So in this sense, self-respect would be respect for all existence, or the entirety of the interconnected universe. So when Roshi buys the wilted lettuce instead of the nice, fresh head that the proprietor urges on him, because he says he feels sorry for it, that is self-respect. There are many koans like this. For example, there's a koan that says, if in the final karmic fire, if the karmic fire burns everything up, at that time will Buddha nature exist? Sometimes the teacher will answer, yes, it will. And another time the teacher will answer, no, it will not exist. And both are true. Someone may ask, well, why did you say it will exist? And the teacher will say, well, what are you thinking? Don't you understand what I mean? The Buddha nature will not exist is right, and that Buddha nature will exist is right. So this is not just a flower. It's the absolute. It is Buddha itself. We see it in that. We Buddhas see it in that way. But at the same time, that which exists is just a flower. So it's Buddha himself, and it's just a flower. And that's the feeling we should have in our practice and in our everyday activity. That whatever work you, and then whatever work you do, will have a continuous feeling of pure gratitude. Roshi says, the Suzuki Roshi says, if you can just appreciate each thing one by one, you will have pure gratitude. So coming back to the poem, even though you observe just one flower, that one flower is the absolute. And even though it finally manifests as a flower, it fully manifests itself as a flower manifestation, due to no self and emptiness of the emptiness and due to impermanence and no self, which is emptiness. This one flower has within it the power to liberate itself from itself. So therefore, spring passes. So it's always the same color, and it has the power to liberate itself from itself, and spring passes. So this little waka is about manifestation. It manifests every single year with the same color, and liberation from that manifestation. Spring passes. And this is true not only of the flower, of course, but we beings listening to this giving and listening to this talk. There's a second waka today that gives a twist to this critical message, and it gives another critical message about impermanence that I think is extremely important. So this other waka doesn't have a title, and it goes like this. Even insentient beings, such as grasses and trees, wither today. Seeing this in front of our eyes, how can we not grieve? I'll read it again. Even insentient beings, such as grasses and trees, wither today. Seeing this in front of our eyes, how can we not grieve? And Okamura Roshi tells us, this is really interesting, he tells us what Kodo Sawaki Roshi said when he talked about this poem. So this is now Kodo Sawaki, right? You remember Kodo Sawaki. He says, he emphasized the quality of our eyes, whether they are open to seeing impermanence and feeling grief about the plants' lives and our own lives. And he compared himself with Dogen, who deeply realized impermanence by experiencing his mother's death when he was 7 years old, seeing the incense smoke at his mother's funeral. Dogen, just seeing that, the incense smoke, that he aspired to become a Buddhist monk. Sawaki Roshi's mother, on the other hand, died when he was 5. His father died when he was 7. He was adopted by his aunt, and before long, her husband died of a stroke right in front of him. And although he had such painful experiences, Sawaki Roshi tells us he did not really see impermanence. Instead, he was only worried about who would feed and raise him. So we know Sawaki Roshi. I hope you remember him. So, and then his next adopted father, Bunkichi Sawaki, was a gambler and lived in the red light district. And I'm sure you remember this. When Sawaki Roshi was 8, a middle-aged man died of a stroke in a prostitute's room nearby. Sawaki Roshi saw the dead man in bed with his wife beside him crying, "Why did you die in a place like this of all places?" Like caring nothing for his dying, but only for herself in the face of the inevitable scandal. And also the prostitute, you know, couldn't care less about it. And she was like on her cell phone or whatever. I mean, not really, but had that attitude. Witnessing this miserable scene, Sawaki Roshi was stunned, and this time impermanence was inscribed deeply in his mind. And so he later says, Dogen Zenji was sharp-witted, so he could deeply see impermanence and arouse the mind of awakening by simply seeing the smoke of incense, or withering trees or grasses, but a dull-witted person like me could not feel the same thing until I had much more intense experiences. So this is the four horses right here. We have the four horses. Dogen is definitely the first horse, and Sawaki Roshi is definitely a fourth horse. So we're seeing this right in front of our eyes. So even though Sawaki Roshi said he was dull-witted, however, compared to Dogen Zenji, I think he was probably the only person there who had eyes to see the full meaning of impermanence in that event. And I wonder, how old were you? How old were you when you saw the full meaning of impermanence? Do you remember the incident? Like, really try to distinguish between your experiences of impermanence that were painful and getting that impermanence and its suffering is a universal law and the very bedrock of Buddhism, whose Four Noble Truths provide an antidote to the suffering. So, for example, I know someone who suffered enormously by the repeated deaths of her beloved dogs. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, I don't know how many. But did this experience of painful suffering, did this inspire her to see impermanence as a universal law and maybe start practicing Buddhism, which has a remedy to the suffering, which is the Eightfold Path? No, it didn't. So this is what Sawaki Roshi is saying. You know, we all suffer from impermanence, but does it make us see anything? And it took him forever, he feels, to get that we're going to experience this, like it or not. This is the suffering that Shakyamuni Buddha was talking about. Life is suffering. It's this suffering. So there's a little end to this story that's very neat. So after Sawaki Roshi became well known as a Zen master, he was invited to give a talk for a group of priests in his hometown. And he talked about his experience of finally realizing impermanence. And when he talked about this brothel scene, one of the priests in the audience remembered that one of the members of one of the families that belonged to his temple died like that several decades before. And he recalled that the strict abbot of the temple at the time was furious about how the man had died, and as a result, he refused to give the man a Dharma name at his funeral. And when Sawaki Roshi heard this, he wrote to the current abbot of that temple, and he said, "That man who died," this is the man who died having done it with the prostitute, as they say, "this man was a great teacher for him who saved him and made him a monk, and he asked that the priest give the dead man a Dharma name as a consequence. This man," Sawaki Roshi says, "who died was a great teacher for me. He saved me and he made me a monk." And this business about the Dharma name, in Japanese Buddhist funerals, it involves ordaining the deceased as if they were becoming a monk or a nun, and as such, they receive a Dharma name in the process. So in this case, the abbot withheld the Dharma name because he disapproved of the manner in which the person died in bed with a prostitute. But Sawaki Roshi wrote him and said, you know, "No, this Buddha saved me. This man in bed with a prostitute saved me, and you should give him a Dharma name." And I think the abbot did give him a Dharma name. So I was very moved by that learning that. So all plants know when to sprout and grow and bloom, etc. And each plant has its own time and season, and we are mindful, and we see that everything in nature expresses the Dharma of impermanence. And particularly, we see plants wither. And if our eyes are open, this is the point of this waka, if our eyes are open, we cannot help but realize the transience of our own lives. Perceiving impermanence and grieving for it is an opportunity to arouse the mind of awakening. So it's very important that we see impermanence and that we do grieve, because these experiences allow us to arouse the mind of awakening. Now, grieving is not a negative in Buddhism. And even though in the sutra on the teachings bequeathed by the Buddha in this sutra, Shakyamuni said regarding his own death, all of you bhikshus, do not be grieved or distressed. If I were to live in the world for an eon, my association with you would still come to an end. A meeting without a separation can never be. The Dharma for benefiting oneself and others is complete. He's talking about himself and his disciples who are listening. The Dharma is complete. If I were to live longer, it would be of no further benefit. All of those who could be crossed over, whether in the heavens above or among humans, have already crossed over. And all of those who have not yet crossed over have already created the causes and conditions for crossing over. Meetings necessarily have separations, so do not harbor grief. Every appearance in the world is like this. Be vigorous, seek liberation right away. Destroy the darkness of delusion with the brightness of wisdom. So even though Buddha encourages his followers not to mourn, sadness about impermanence is not considered a negative. Awakening to the truth of suffering, the first noble truth, is the starting point of Buddhist study and practice. And so it's an opportunity to practice what the Buddha taught. And that what the Buddha taught in one place is summarized as what's called the five remembrances. Some of you, I think, know about the five remembrances, and I'm going to end with these five remembrances. The first remembrance: I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. The second remembrance: my nature is to have ill health. Illness is inevitable. The third remembrance: by nature, I will die. There is no escaping death. The fourth remembrance: all that is precious and beloved to me is of the nature to change. Being separated from my loved ones is preordained. The fifth remembrance: by nature, my actions belong to me. They are mine. Every moment I am born from them, and I am their heir. Whether wholesome or unwholesome, I cannot avoid what they bring about. And that statement is about karma. We cannot avoid our karma, the causes and conditions that we've laid down. So here are some of the most important points. First, there is a big difference between having painful experiences of loss and seeing impermanence as the first noble truth. Life is suffering. That's the first noble truth. There's a big difference in having painful experiences of loss and seeing impermanence as the first noble truth. Life is suffering. Second, things are manifested completely as they are, and yet, at the same time, they are liberated from what they are due to impermanence and no self. Third, impermanence is not a negative in Buddhism. Sadness about impermanence is also not considered a negative in Buddhism. Often, they arouse the mind of awakening. Fourth, if you can just appreciate each thing one by one, then you will have pure gratitude. That's Suzuki Roshi. Fifth, everything is without any fixed self nature, and therefore everything is changing all the time. Sixth, although he had such painful experiences, Sawaki Roshi said he did not really see impermanence. Rather, he only worried about who would feed and raise him. I think that's kind of all of us. And lastly, even though you observe just one flower, that one flower includes everything. It's not just a flower. It is the Absolute. It is Buddha himself. So that's like the title of the talk, Flowers of Emptiness. And here are some ideas for your personal reflection and journaling during the week. First, we've learned that it's not what happens to us, but rather whether we are able to see something larger in what happens to us. And I myself saw the shifting nature of reality, that nothing was reliable, very early, but I didn't enlarge that to a universal law, and I didn't name it as impermanence. And how about you? What was the experience in your life that gave you the insight of the truth of impermanence as a universal law? So I'm inviting you to connect with that time of seeing impermanence as something way bigger than just what just happened to you, and hopefully writing about it, since writing is a process of discovery. Second, the next time you see a baby or a puppy or a kitten, try to see at the same time that as they are manifesting as a baby, at the same time you see them as a baby, you see this little kitten, but also try to see that they have a force inside that will liberate them from this very form. Stop. Look at the being closely and think about this force. It will help you ground this terribly important truth for you. So this is like an assignment the next time you see a puppy or a kitten or a baby or another precious small being. Third, when we hear the words of Suzuki Roshi, today we may be very happy, and the next day we don't know what will happen to us. We heard those early on in this series of lectures. Could you explain what they mean by giving a personal example? So the personal example of today we may be very happy, and the next day we don't know what will happen to us. It's like great, and then oh my God, this is a disaster. Pakistan is having a disaster right now, and Sahar is not with us today because she's attending to a disaster. But last week she was with us, and I hope that she was very happy. And then the next day there are floods all over her country, and we don't know what will happen to us. And everything is interconnected, so we too don't know what will happen to us. Which brings us to the fourth thing to write on. Which of the five remembrances touches you most deeply? Which of the five remembrances touches you most deeply? And the fifth, although the Buddha encourages his followers not to mourn, sadness about impermanence is not considered a negative in Buddhism. In fact, awakening to the truth of suffering, the first of the Four Noble Truths, is a starting point of Buddhist study and practice. Not everyone gets, though, that the sole reason of Buddhism, the whole point of Buddhism, is to relieve suffering caused by the endless cycles of birth, sickness, old age, and death. These endless cycles that we create by our greed, hate, and delusion, these endless cycles create so much suffering. But to find Buddhism that within it has a path toward out of suffering. Most people don't even know that that's what Buddhism is about. And I wonder about you. Before you found Buddhism, what was your idea about suffering? What was your understanding of suffering before you found Buddhism? That's what this question is. Once you found Buddhism, the teaching is life is suffering, and that there's the suffering, there's a cause of our suffering, which is the causes and conditions that we've laid down in our previous life and this life. But there is a cessation to suffering. There's a way out of suffering, and that's the Fourth Noble Truth, the Eightfold Noble Path. So before you came upon Buddhism, however that was, what was your idea of suffering? That's my question to you to write about, or at least think about. I'm wondering if you want me to repeat the five remembrances, because I ask you which one is the most important, just very quickly. The first, I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. The second, my nature is to have ill health. Illness is inevitable. Third, by nature I will die. There is no escaping death. Fourth, all that is precious and beloved to me is of the nature to change. Being separated from my loved ones is preordained. And fifth, by nature my actions belong to me. They are mine. Every moment I am born from them, and I am their heir. Whether wholesome or unwholesome, I cannot avoid what they bring about. Those are the five. I wonder if you have questions.
Yes, Gail, we have some questions. Here's the first one. I have a lot of suffering and I see so many around me also suffering, and now the whole world is suffering and I feel completely helpless. This idea that the sole reason for the existence of Buddhism is to relieve suffering, which I keep forgetting, how does this work? I know you've told us, I'm sorry.
Don't apologize for forgetting, everybody does. It helps if you remember Siddhartha, who was Buddha before he had his experience of awakening, and that he was a prince ready to become king, and his father protected him from seeing any of these ugly things about life. But Siddhartha had these experiences of getting out of the palace every once in a while, and he saw old age, sickness, and death, and he was shocked. And when he was shocked, he decided to leave the palace, including his wife and son, in order to find how to solve this terrible problem. Like, what is this all there is for us? And he did this by meditating, and he did a lot of austerities that Buddhism doesn't really include, but that was his practice at the time, for 6 years. And then he sat under the Bo tree and he had an awakening experience. And from his awakening experience, and this is what I was telling you about Dogen in the beginning, Dogen is not just expounding thinking. He's telling us what he experienced in his Zazen, and the Buddha is telling us the four noble truths. That was aroused from his long sitting under the Bo tree, and the four noble truths are: life is suffering. Number one, there's a cause for suffering, karma. There's cessation of suffering. It's possible to cease the suffering. And the fourth, and here's how to get out of your suffering, the Eightfold Noble Path. So basically, you asked how it works. And how it works is that the Eightfold Path, if you follow it, it will cure you of your greed, hate, and delusion. The greed in Buddhism, it's said that the greed, hate, and delusion of all of us keeps the cyclical path of birth, sickness, old age, and death. That cycle, it is kept in motion by our greed, hate, and delusion. And when you live by the Four Noble Truths, and especially the Eightfold Path, you melt away greed, hate, and delusion. And I was just listening to a talk yesterday by Reb Anderson, Roshi. Who said that it was on repentance, it was on confession and repentance. And so people were bringing forth things that they were confessing and repenting, actually. And Reb said that confessing and repenting melts away the root causes of the thing that you're confessing. Not just melts away that bad, quote, bad action, but, or at least in your mind, something that you regret doing, but it melts away the root cause of that action. Confession and repentance melts away the root cause. And so, in the same way, I think healing our greed, hate, and delusion by living by the Four Noble Truths and then the Eightfold Noble Path is a way that melts away. Living by the Eightfold Path melts away our greed, hate, and delusion. And so then we become our presence within samsara is different. And so following the Eightfold Path, your life becomes like an offering. And don't forget, offerings live on. When your life is an offering, your life lives on as an offering. And so you're living for more than yourself, and that's how the Eightfold Path works. And I hope this helps you. I really thank you for asking, because I think a lot of people have this question. And so in a way, it was a gift. Your question was a gift. Thank you.
Here's the next question. They write, "This isn't a question so much as an appreciation of Balanchine and his magnificent gesture to Tchaikovsky. Had I been in the audience, I would have been stunned, definitely awakened to my own transience. By making the audience a part of the performance, he forced them to see that they are the performance. This is you. This is your life. Dear, you must wake up right now," is what he is saying. "Thank you for bringing this graphic example to our attention."
You know, I bring it to your attention because it has a personal resonance for me. When I was in 10th grade, the teacher praised a paragraph that I wrote. And that was the first, so I had my first thought of being a writer. And then in 11th grade, my English teacher had a sign on her wall that said, "This is not a dress rehearsal, this is it." And so I was deeply impressed by those words, which said to me, yes, I have to be a writer. And then the whole thing got quenched, and it didn't reemerge for 20 years. But even then, though, I remembered the words about, this is not a dress rehearsal, this is it. And I got right to it. And if we're alert to impermanence and no self, we get a lot more done. That's all. We just get a lot more done in our life. The sooner we see impermanence, like, this is not a dress rehearsal, this is it, the more we get done in our life. So that's why I was so moved by the Balanchine story. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, how is buying wilted lettuce self-respect? I'm sorry to make you repeat.
I know, a lot of people don't understand this. So in the Zen Center meal chant, it says, to practice our way, we eat this food. To practice our way, we eat this food. And so it's a chant saying how big mind is included in what we eat, in how we eat. And remember that Shakyamuni Buddha and many monks after he died, and many, many monks, including today, use begging as their way of sustenance, having sustenance. And they go out with this bowl one time a day in the morning, and they receive an offering, and then they give them back a prayer, and then they go and they eat whatever they got. And that's hopefully before noon, and then they don't eat the rest of the day. So they're not bothered by eating after that. So they get this offering, which they have no control over what that is, but it's enough for them. It's food. So they eat the food. to practice our way, we eat this food. So they eat the food, they're sustained, no one dies, and they don't have to worry about food at all. And so they give, by begging, they give away their greed. And Suzuki Roshi's rescuing the wilted lettuce, he was rescuing the part of himself, the small part of the whole interconnected universe, that was dying there in the lettuce bin. He felt for the lettuce, a part of him and a part of the entire interconnected universe. And so this is big mind, not what should I have for lunch today. So they both exist. They both exist. I'm not putting down what should I have for lunch today, but to practice our way we eat this food should be, it's helpful. It's helpful to include that thought in what we have for lunch today when we finally decide. We remember that we're eating in order to practice our way. Then you just gobble up the food. Okay, that's all.
The next question is, I know the five remembrances, I have them posted on my refrigerator. It's the fourth one that I can't read, it's so painful. It seems like it's one thing to recognize impermanence and another to digest it and live without ones that you love. Is Buddha saying to love but don't be attached? How do you do that?
I don't know, because I can't do that. But the teaching is about seeing the interconnected wholeness of everything, impermanence and no self. And I want you to know that I have many times seen Zen masters grieve enormously for the loss of a loved one and usually a beloved disciple, and vice versa. Students, including myself, grieved enormously when Suzuki Roshi died, for example. It's one of the worst kinds of suffering, I think. And while grieving is not considered a negative in Buddhism, I think that excessive grieving, like, for example, if your life stops and you keep, you know, let's say your husband died and you keep the bedroom exactly as he left it when he died for 10 years, and you have not moved on from your life at all, I think this kind of grieving is about attachment, and it's the attachment part that's the problem. So let's see, I want to be clear about this. I think I'm saying I don't know how to grieve a loved one without being attached, but I think there comes a point where you appreciate the path of your loved one. To die just because birth and death go together, and as you will die also. And so you just let go. So I guess I'm saying that I don't want to be saying what I say. I want to say what Buddhism says, and Buddhism condones grieving, but I don't think it condones excessive attachment in that situation. And I could be wrong, but that's what I think. I'm not sure we have time for another question. What do you think? Is there another question? Maybe it's time to end. And before that, I want to be sure to thank Sahar, who's not here, but working hard for her country. and Brian, who is here, who just did Sahar's job. Thank you so much. And Brendan, who works behind the scenes very hard to make these talks possible. Thank you so much. And I hope I see you next week. Bye-bye.